the King. We're talking about the book of Matthew, the Mostly Matthew series that we're in. And we are looking at the King and His kingdom. Everything Jesus came to teach us was about His kingdom. That was the main focus, the kingdom. So if you go and read the book of Matthew, you'll see Jesus say, kingdom, 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 king, 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 kingdom, 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 over and over and over again. If you miss that point, God help you. If that's the point of the book, that everything you read in that book has to start from that point when you interpret it. I mean, that's what interpretation is all about. Every time I teach you one of the Bible books, it doesn't matter which one we are in, I try to, in the introduction, say, this book is about blah. I mean, the whole big picture, in a nutshell. The one main concept that this book is about is this. It was written for this one main reason. Why is that so important? So that every time you go into it and you begin to look at it, each detail fits into that theme. That's like me saying, I'm going to write an essay on chickens. And then I start the first paragraph talking about snakes, and another paragraph in there talking about dinosaurs, and then one about brick making. And you're saying, this guy doesn't have a clue about chickens, right? And I wouldn't. But you know what? A lot of people come to the book of Matthew, and they make this section talk about this thing, and this section talk about that thing, and this chapter over here talk about another thing. And after a while, it becomes apparent they don't know anything about the book of Matthew. Everything in the book of Matthew is about the King and the kingdom. And if you don't use that as your starting reference point, you will bomb through a whole bunch of interpretations. You'll get them wrong. So, assuming that the author of the book was just not randomly selecting his material, every time you come to a passage, every time you come to a story or a parable, every time you come to a section, what is the first idea that should cross your mind when reading it? What does this have to do with the King and His kingdom? And if you can't answer that question, keep looking for the answer. Because Matthew was a sharp guy. And this morning I'm going to show you how much smarter he is than you. Are you ready for it? I'm going to show you how smart he was. Jesus is king by birth. And we just went through the Christmas season, and I've kind of avoided giving you a Christmas story. Well, here we are. We're in the heart of the Christmas story stuff now, and we're right into it. And I told you, I'm not going to delve deeply into this, so I just covered all this genealogy last week by saying, yes, verse 1, Jesus is son of Abraham and son of David. He's the king. And he comes to fulfill these two covenant promises. So he's the king by birth. Really, that's the point of the genealogy there. The point of the birthplace, Bethlehem, the city of David. And it's the point of the Magi coming. The Magi are the wise men of the East from these other countries. And they come and acknowledge who Jesus is as the king. And I'll refer to them in a moment. But we have the Son of God and the Son of David. The Son of God and the Son of David. So let's... What the passages I'm covering now are those little stories of around Jesus' birth. Specifically in the book of Matthew, in this first chapters, you have Matthew stating a prophecy or telling a story and then connecting them together. So what I'm doing this morning is I'm looking at these little prophetic bits, these little stories, and Matthew will say, and Jesus went down to Egypt, and here's the prophecy that goes with it. Or this other thing happened, and here's the prophecy that go with it. And I'm going to look at these prophecies this morning, and we're going to pile this on top of the foundation we had last week. Again, this is one of those foundational ones, and you're going to leave here with your brains being full, I hope. So here we go. Jesus is a Greek word for a Hebrew word. Remember, he's not Greek. But, you know, we call Jesus by a Greek name. Isn't that interesting? Here he is. He's a Hebrew. and we call him by his Greek name, and we've done it. You are so Greek, and you don't know it. You call so many famous people by their Greek names. Why? Because, well, Greeks controlled the history, and they wrote a lot of stuff down. And your New Testament was written in, oh, that's right, written in Greek. But that wasn't his real original name. When he grew up at home, his mom didn't say Jesus, she said Joshua or Yeshua, come here. That was the language that he grew up with. Jesus then has the word Zeus in it, which is interesting if you look at the Greek part of it. It's Yesuus, and you see the idea of God that's embedded in the word there as well. But the word Joshua is obviously one that you see in the Old Testament, starting very early on, and it means Yahweh is salvation, or Yahweh saves. Yahweh is the name of God, okay? That's the YHWH, we call that the Tetragrammaton, and that in your Old Testaments, when you see an all caps word, Lord, usually, L-O-R-D, and it's in all capitals, sometimes it's God, G-O-D in all capitals, that's this word Yahweh. Some of the old translations translated it Jehovah. Okay, so that's all I'm speaking about. But I don't like, you know, I don't typically say Jehovah unless I'm combining one of his names like Jehovah Jireh or something like that. The word here is Yahweh, the name of God that he reveals himself by. Yahweh is salvation. Yahweh saves. That's the name of God in the Old Testament. So Matthew 1:21, she shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. This idea of saviors tied right in there. So Jesus comes to bring salvation that Yahweh promises in the Old Testament. Yahweh promises the salvation, and it's going to come through Jesus. Yahweh saves through Joshua. Psalm 138. And he, Yahweh, will redeem Israel from all his iniquities. In other words, sins. So this is the same idea. You got Yahweh and saving. So Yahweh, saving, and iniquities. And here you have Jesus saving sins. All right? That's the verse that you're really looking at there. So that's the first part that Matthew brings up. The second one is this name Emmanuel. Sometimes a lot of our hymns and stuff, it'll be spelled with an E. I is maybe a better way of doing it, but Emmanuel either way. And it means God with us. You're used to seeing this one all the time, right? At Christmas time, is the big Emmanuel stories come around. Well, this is a very important story. If you look in Matthew 1:23, here's this quotation again. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they will call his name Emmanuel, which means God with us. So in Matthew 1:23, he's again taken a prophecy of the Old Testament and applied it to Jesus. But these prophecies are difficult, all of them. And so we need to jump into the Old Testament and really understand what's going on to be able to pick out what Matthew's point is. Because you just jump on that and go, oh yeah, that's simple. Jesus was born of a virgin, la, la, la. But if you go back to Isaiah where this is written, it's not so simple. It's really not so simple. The word virgin there actually just means young woman. It has nothing to do with her virginity. And the word Emmanuel there is not even talking about Jesus in the original passage. So are we just jumping to conclusions and ripping prophecies out and applying to Jesus? Well, let's see. Is Matthew smarter than you? Well, we'll see. Let's see how much smarter he is than you. Well, the name Emmanuel is tied in the Old Testament to the Davidic covenant. And what did we talk about all last week? And fill your brains up to overflowing. We talked about this idea of the Davidic covenant and the Abrahamic covenant and what covenants were. So to really understand this, we have to have this Old Testament flashback. We have to go into Isaiah chapter 6 to 12. Yeah, that much. It's a huge passage. This prophecy about the virgin conceiving and giving birth to this Emmanuel is a long passage of scripture, 6 to 12 in the book of Isaiah. Very significant. And it follows on Isaiah's calling and the stump that will be cut down and the righteous branch that will come out of it. All this is tied in this one passage. So let's jump in here and see really what's going on in this section of Isaiah. God had promised a judgment against the land because of the people's sin. Okay, very common theme. We're going to have this foreign power come in and wipe you out because you're sinning against me. So that's really what you get into in Isaiah chapter 6. Stuff like, it's going to be bad for everybody here. And Isaiah says, well, how bad is it going to be? Oh, bad. You know, Isaiah, in his calling, he said, God says to him, Isaiah, I want you to go and tell people how bad it's going to be. I mean, and it's going to be bad. And Isaiah hears what he's supposed to tell people, and he says, that's pretty bad. And he says, how long do I have to give this message out? Oh, until everything's wiped bare. Oh, how'd you like that job? That's just not a good, successful feeling. So the people were going to be sent into exile, but a portion were going to remain in the land. And that remnant was going to be like the stump of a tree. The tree was being cut down, but there would be a remnant kept in the land like a stump of a tree. Now, different trees do different things, but we had a willow tree in our backyard. And man, we cut that sucker off, and it said, I am not done yet. You know, and it just grew back out of the stump. So, Jesus even uses this prophecy when he's talking about his own ministry, later on when we'll get to it in the book of Matthew, in chapter 13. And he uses it when he's asked, why do you speak to the people in parables? He quotes from this section that we're in Isaiah right now. So the disciples say, Jesus, why do you teach the people in parables? And Jesus says, I speak to them in parables so they won't know what I'm talking about. You know, this is one of the common misconceptions people have of Jesus. Jesus was this great teacher. He just brought everything down to earth, and he talked about fields and farming because everybody understood that. And Jesus, if you ask him, he says, no, I talk about things so people won't have a clue what I'm talking about. You know, can you imagine going to listen to Jesus? Oh, yeah, we're going to go with Jesus. And you go, you show up, and Jesus said, there's this farmer, and he went out in the field, and he scattered some seed, and the birds ate it up. End of story. And everybody went, oh, that's deep. No, they didn't. They said, where's the bread? Do we get bread now? And the disciples said, why do you do that? I'm kind of getting ahead of myself in the sermons. And Jesus said, I do this so they will hear me speak and not get a thing out of it. Aren't you glad your pastor doesn't take that same philosophy? And they said, well, why do you do that? And he quotes this passage from Isaiah. And he says to them, basically, so those that truly want my truth will ask me about it. See, it's the passage where the disciples come and say, tell us what the parable of the sower means. Oh, yeah, this is what it means. And he explains it to them. You see, there were a lot of people who followed Jesus for the wrong reason. And so it was a form of judgment against them to really separate those who wanted to follow Jesus for the right reasons and those who were following Jesus for the wrong reasons. Now, not everything Jesus said was in parables. So, back in here to the Emmanuel prophecy, the events surrounding the prophecy. In Isaiah 7 to 12, we get into this long section in prophecy. And I'm going to step through chapter by chapter and tell you the history that's going on here. First, the kingdoms of Syria and Israel were threatening Judah. So understand, Judah and Israel are two different nations, although they're one people. Okay, don't forget that. One of those concepts, you're talking about Israel, Judah is in the south, Israel's in the north. They've been divided. Assyria, which is even more in the north, and Israel are both threatening Judah. Judah's scared. Oh, what shall we do, right? So, in this prophecy, Judah is being given a chance to choose good rather than evil. God is saying, I'm giving you a time period here. You can be like Israel in the north, or you can repent and be who I'm calling you to be. You have a chance to learn the good and choose it, or to reject it and turn to evil. And in this, by the time Isaiah's son Emmanuel, that's whose child it was, the prophet's son, Isaiah, by the time his son Emmanuel reached the age given in the prophecy, Assyria would sweep through the land. That's the time period. So the prophecy that when Isaiah delivers it to the people, imagine he comes into the people and he says, here's my little boy. Or maybe the boy wasn't born yet. But I'm going to have a son. And his name, we're going to call him Emmanuel. And by the time he's able to choose right and wrong, good and evil, and eat this certain kind of food, you better have this sorted out. Because that's when Assyria is coming. And what happens to you is all based down on what you choose to do. Like a child who chooses right and wrong, good and evil, you need to choose as well. So the prophecy declared that one day a child would be born as the Davidic heir. There's a little bit more in there. And this Davidic heir is going to be the Messiah. He would be the righteous branch that grows out of the stump of the cut down tree, and he would restore Israel. And in that day, all Israel would rejoice in God the Savior. And that's what you get to in Isaiah chapter 12. Aren't you glad I'm not reading all the chapters for you this morning? So the prophecy of Emmanuel was about a new king in Judah who would bring God's salvation, Yahweh's salvation. That's what the prophecy in this section is about. He would not be like the ungodly kings that precipitated the Babylonian captivity. He would be different. And that's where you get this coming in. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God. Interesting title to give to a man, isn't it? Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end. On the throne of David, fulfilling the Davidic covenant, and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. This is what Matthew's talking about. He's referring to this whole large section. When he quotes this one little bit, he's talking about this whole promise of a Davidic covenant who would restore the throne of David after the exile, something that had not happened yet. That's why this is so important. Now, let me return to the Magi for a moment that I referenced at the very beginning. I like the Magi. I think the Magi are awesome. I have my own theories of the Magi. I have big theories of the Magi. Anyway, the Magi. They're important because they come and accept Jesus as king while he's still an infant. That's what's so important about the Magi. Even when Jesus is a baby, they come to and acknowledge that he is king. What's more significant is that they are Gentiles. They are Gentiles from another land who acknowledge Jesus as king. They accept him as king when he's a baby, and they're Gentiles, and the Jewish people reject him, even through his whole life. And that's what you're supposed to see here. It foreshadows everything that happens in Matthew in the book of Acts. Some will recognize him as king, even Gentiles. Very important theme in the book of Matthew and into the book of Acts. So the story of Jesus' birth is a comparison between him, the rightful king, even known and acknowledged by Gentiles, and Herod, the king of the Jews, who's a murderer, who doesn't belong on the throne, who isn't the rightful king, who doesn't fulfill any prophecies in the line of David. Herod received his position from Rome. Jesus receives his from God. Herod was a murderer, and Jesus was a sacrificial lover. Well, I'm going to continue on because we aren't done here. There's a few more prophecies I want to sort out. Now, at first glance, these next two quotations from the Old Testament don't seem to make perfect sense. But when understood correctly, it shows how deep Matthew understood the Old Testament. In other words, how much smarter he was than you and me. All right, so let's go in here. The first one is about Rachel's tears. You know, you read this one in the book of Matthew. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and loud lamentation. Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because there are no more. Now this prophecy, Matthew ties it to what? To when Herod kills the children of Bethlehem. Now, if you're in the story of Herod killing the children in Bethlehem, and you read this prophecy, and you aren't smarter than Matthew, you go, oh yeah. And then you turn back to where the prophecy is given, and you go, well, he sure ripped this one out of context, didn't he? And then if you study it, you go, wow, Matthew was smarter than me. So let's get to that point together. So at first, it seems like we're pulling a text from the Old Testament and we're fitting it in somewhere that it doesn't belong. After all, Rachel wasn't weeping because Herod killed the babies in Bethlehem. I mean, you can't even try to read that in there. It's just not there. And this is one of the things, and the reason I want to explain these to you, is these are the kind of things that somebody will look at the Bible, and they'll say, see this prophecy, did you ever read the original context? And you read it, and they go, you know, it's just making stuff up. Well, it looks like it's making up stuff if you're not smarter than Matthew. So, what was Rachel weeping about? Now, we know it's not Rachel herself, because she died before the prophet, 1,000 years before the prophecy, more than that. Rachel is just used as the mother of the people of Israel, okay? She's just the mother. So it's just this general word. It's like when Ephraim is called, Ephraim my son. It's just one name of a person being representative of the entire people of Israel. What was Rachel crying about? Well, the tears of Rachel mark something in that Old Testament passage. The beginning of the Jewish exile to Babylon. That's what was going on. So if you read the prophecy, it's about Rachel weeping for her children. It's about the people of Judah being carried off to Babylon and the end of the Davidic kingdom. That ended. It was over. So all this thing about, I will put a son of yours on the throne forever, it stopped. It stopped. The tears, then, are mentioned here in the New Testament because they mark the end of exile. Why does Rachel stop crying? Because the king had finally come back. And that's why Matthew uses this one here. The exile has come to an end because the true king has come. In other words, this prophecy is used here by Matthew, if you look at the original text that comes out in the Old Testament, to say the legitimate king who will fulfill the Davidic covenant has come. And now we can move past the verse on crying. What's past the verse on crying? Well, you got to go back to the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah 31:15 talks about Rachel crying. But if you read later on in that passage, same chapter, it says, after the tears end, God will establish the new covenant. All the passages about the new covenant that you read about, the quotations, they're all taken from Jeremiah 31, 31 to 34. And they're all come after the weeping of Rachel. The new covenant can't come until the weeping ends. And the weeping doesn't end until the exile's over. And the exile isn't over until the Davidic king comes. That's why Matthew's smarter than you. Next one. Out of Egypt I called my son. Matthew 2:15. This is Jesus, right? They're under threat. They go down to Egypt. They hang out there for a while till Herod dies. And then they come back. And then this verse, out of Egypt I called my son, which is clearly talking about the people of Israel coming out of Egypt and into the land of promise. And Matthew's pulled that one out and used it to talk about Jesus. What? Well, what's he talking about? Matthew's point is that Jesus is the true Israel, the true Son of God. Who is the Son? Who is a Son of God? Well, the one that's like the Father. The one that bears the likeness. See, this is where Israel failed at being the Son of God. Because they never really bore his likeness. They never had his value system. They were under judgment. And they were still under judgment because of their sin. Even though they were back in the land, they were still not free. They were still in Egypt. In their own land. They had been a dominated people since the Babylonians. They were always under judgment. In Jesus' day, they were not an independent nation. They were ruled by foreigners, even their homeland. They were still in a form of Egyptian bondage. And they would remain that way until they repented and acknowledged who the true king was. All of these apply to Jesus as king. Remember, last week, what did David understand that Saul didn't? David understood that he wasn't the king. What do all the Jewish leaders in Jesus' day not understand? They still don't understand who the true king is, especially the Sadducees. They're happy to have Rome be king as long as they get to be number two. Jesus came to bring freedom from bondage. Well, what's the true source of bondage that the Old Testament and the New Testament speak about? Bondage comes from choosing a value system other than God's. Really, the place of bondage is in our hearts to sin. We are all in bondage to sin. That's what Paul spends a lot of time talking about. So what does Jesus come to do? He comes to deal the final blow to rebellion, to lead the people out of Egypt, out of bondage, just to take them out of sin. And that's what he's come to do. And we get to this last one. Oh boy. You know, if you're on the edge with Matthew being smarter than you, you're ready for this one. The Nazarene. I don't know if I have this one up here. Yeah. Jesus went and lived in Nazareth, right? And he went and lived in a city called Nazareth that was spoken by the prophets, that what was spoken by the prophets might be fulfilled. He shall be called a Nazarene. Now, there's a curious part to this prophecy. Very curious part. It doesn't exist. Now, if you're looking at the previous two prophecies, kind of going, well, Matthew, you're kind of pushing the envelope here. He gets right into it here. And he quotes the prophets when they didn't have anything to say. How does this work for you? Now, for some of the people, they'll say, well, obviously the prophecy was given and it was an oral tradition, or we lost that book, or blah, 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 blah. You don't need to do that at all. There's a key word in here, and it's this one. See that S on the end of it? That's a very, very important S. That's why Matthew says prophets and not a specific prophet. In other words, what Matthew is trying to do here is present to you a general concept. And if you go and study the prophets, Isaiah and Jeremiah and the minor prophets, you'll see them all testify that the Messiah who will come in David's throne will have something similar about him. And that similar thing is he will be rejected. Being called a Nazarene foretells Christ's rejection. Why is this important? Why is it important that he's raised in Nazareth? Well, he's not affiliated with David. Here he is, the son of David, born in Bethlehem, comes out of Egypt, now he's raised in Nazareth. It's because he's raised with an idea of antagonism against him, that he was from Nazareth. He's rejected, he's an outcast, nobody knows who he truly is. Well, how do we see this expressed? You see Nathanael in John chapter 1 express this idea. One of the other disciples come to him. Oh, come on, I found the teacher. Come listen to him. Well, where's he from? Oh, he's from Nazareth. Oh. And Nathanael says, can anything good come out of Nazareth? All right? Later on, the Jews, when they want to speak bad things against the followers of Christ in the book of Acts, what do they call the Christians before they call them Christians? They call them the sect of the Nazarenes. All right? It was a derogatory thing to say that. You know, I don't know about you, but there's every place, every culture, every people, they have these people that you kind of pick on. So when you grew up and you went to school, your school was the great one, but the other school was, oh, that was a bad one. And if somebody transferred schools, or you moved somewhere and you went to the bad place, or the other town, or the other community, or whatever, there was the negative thing to say about it. So Nazareth was the armpit of Israel. All right? So that's what they're saying with this language. And Matthew's saying, yep, that's just what the prophet said. That's how they'll treat the Christ. Well, where do we see this? Well, you see it in texts like Isaiah 53:2. For he grew up before him like a young plant, like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look on him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. I talked to you before about what it means to look at somebody and be blessed by God. So to hide your face from somebody means to not look at them, to not bless them, to not accept them. They don't accept Jesus as the Messiah. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his stripes we are healed. What does it mean that Jesus is called the Nazarene? It means he was rejected for who he truly was. He was rejected as being associated with David. They associated him with Nazareth. Jesus did not come establishing a kingdom like the kings of the earth. He came associating himself with the despised, the rejected, and the trampled. He came to undo the punishment and tears associated with sin. Until a person comes to the true king, he remains exiled from God. The only means by which you can avoid the judgment of God and be blessed is by being identified with the righteous king who will represent you in a new covenant with God. That is what these passages in Matthew are saying. They're taking all these concepts, judgment, sin, rejection, they're laying the foundation for the life of Christ, how he would be treated, who would accept him, who would not accept him, and what a difference it would make whether you accepted or rejected him. That's all Matthew is laying out here. And it's pretty deep if you understand the Old Testament as well as he did.